This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Okay, welcome to Talk of Asian Marketing. This is show number 10, which actually is a research supplement where we're going to go deeper into research issues. Every once in a while, we'll have one of these shows that matches up with one of our regular shows. And these shows are oriented towards marketing researchers or marketing practitioners who really want to get more of that detail of what we're talking about. And we've certainly got a lot of that detail. And with a lot of that detail here is Stephen Huang, who's from National Kaohsiung First University of Science and Technology. Stephen, how you doing?
Fine.
That's great. You're always fine.
Yes.
And also we have James Stanworth, who's here with us from National Tsinghua University of Education. James, how you doing?
I'm doing good. It always brightens up my day to hear both of you on the line, and especially since we're set to do an exciting show talking about some of the underlying methodologies and research approach that we use to create the findings we talk about. It should be real good.
Yeah, today's show we're going to get a little bit detailed, and on the webpage we have a few downloads. We're going to have a lot of pictures on there, too, that are related to the research we're talking about. So if you're listening, maybe you want to download that and get with the program so you can keep up with what we're doing. Okay, basically, I'm going to start off by saying, you know, let's remember the topic was coffee, which is a consumption item. And it was pointed out in my research when I was presenting this to some government officials recently that, you know, the biggest issue they think exists is that coffee really is a hedonistic consumption item. There's no reason you have to have it, especially if you're in Asia where tea is, especially in China and Japan, tea is really the big one, the social consumption item. And even when you're alone, you consume it. So coffee's not something anyone has to have. And so they thought this was a big issue. Now, Stephen, I know that you've worked with some other people early, maybe in the 90s, looking at some coffee research when coffee was first coming into Taiwan. Could you tell us what were some of the methodologies you guys were using to look at the market and consumers and what was going on?
Yes, most of the studies we used the focus group and the questionnaire survey. For the focus group, we want to know how consumer prepared the tools and the process to make coffee or to drink coffee, and besides we like to know how consumer perceive the coffee in their daily life.
Well, that's interesting. And that really fits in with what we talked about last week. So you're really looking at how they prepare their coffee.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And, besides, we use the questionnaire survey to know the time, occasion, and the place the consumer consume the coffee, especially the canned coffee. We just talked about last week.
Yeah, ready to consume coffee.
Yes.
And that coffee, I should point out, is sold everywhere. That could be cold or hot.
Yep. And we would like to know the brand awareness and the price and the taste. What kind of the price and what kind of the taste consumer will accept more acceptable.
Interesting. So when you were doing your focus groups, were you involved in any of that? How many people did you get into those focus groups? And what were the kind of topics out of all those topics you just mentioned that you used inside your focus groups?
Yeah, because we would like to know the perception of the coffee of the consumer. So we ask them how they are feeling, and how their perception and how their image about the coffee.
So really, really looking at how they perceive that.
Yes, yes.
And you mentioned tea, so you were kind of contrasting that with tea. Is that the idea?
Yep, yep, right.
Let me, I just want to dive in to ask Stephen about the carrying out focus groups with Chinese people, because often we have that classic statement, people say, people don't like to talk, and it's a key feature of classes, and I'm sure everyone's sort of read about that. But when you're doing a focus group, how easy is it to get that group of people to start talking and interacting in that real dynamic that you want in a focus group, Stephen?
Yeah, so we need an expert to warm up,
like a facilitator, to get them warmed up.
Yes, and because we separate consumer into three or two groups, they have the same hobby or the same personal characteristics and some kind of the same lifestyle. So after the warming up, they feel very comfortable, or they feel very similar with the others.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good point. Yes, you've got to get people relaxed, and then they feel more open.
Yes.
So the warm up was really focused on making people feel really comfortable in the group, and lowered the risk of sharing and participation, I guess, from what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting.
So it's important, if you're going to do this kind of focus group in China, you really need to have a local person who's good at it.
Good at that warm up, for sure.
I think that's a key point.
That's a really interesting point.
I can imagine if you got a group of people together for a focus group and you got this white guy from the UK or America walk in, it'd be a difficult thing to warm up.
Yeah, it really sounds like it. I have to say that, well, as we all know, in class, it takes several classes to get people comfortable and willing to participate. In the first class, where usually the instructor's doing most of the talking. So in the focus group, you don't have that privilege of a second, third time around.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's a really, really important point.
Yes.
Stephen, what were some of your findings you came up with? Because it seemed like you were really focusing in the focus group on matching perceptions with different lifestyles.
Yes. Different group perceived a different image of coffee, and some group think coffee is a refresh stuff. They just want because as we know, Chinese are always a workaholic. They want to keep themselves refresh
so kind of like an energy boost.
Yeah. So they in this situation, they would like to drink coffee and start again on their work.
Yeah. So maybe during your office hours or when you're doing some late night studying.
Yeah, always during the overtime work. When they work overtime, they drink coffee.
Which is, working overtime is just totally normal in Taiwan. I don't think anybody even calls it overtime.
I was going to say, I'm just kind of wondering what you define as overtime. Overtime is kind of the 25th hour of the day.
Yeah, right. Overtime is where you drop dead, right? So this was a key point then. Some people saw it as being that energy boost.
Yes.
What else did you find? That's very interesting.
But the different group perceive coffee as relaxing.
Relaxing. So that's such a contrast right there. Different market segments can have totally opposite perspective.
Right.
So you've got people who use it as energy booster and other people who use it as a relaxer, energy releaser.
Yeah, eraser. And along with the eraser, this group of the third group perceive coffee as the exotic feeling.
Exotic.
Or the foreign culture.
That's very interesting. Yes, it's sort of like in the UK where they introduced things like star fruits and kiwi fruits some while ago when they started appearing in the shops. They were described exactly the same way, kind of as exotic fruits, and slowly they become a norm. So that's interesting because you're doing that work like sort of 5-8 years ago. So coffee was labeled as exotic at that stage. Very interesting. Exactly the same word, but different meanings.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Stephen. What else did you find?
Respondents think coffee as a process of a civilization. So they place the different different meaning of exotic feeling or the exotic stuff, as James just said.
Kind of a, I would think that falls in the category of kind of a modernity kind of feeling.
Modernity.
Interesting.
That it makes sense because of what you see others doing in different cultures that you label as more advanced than your own for some abstract reason. So
That's a good point. And in fact, Sherry has a paper that's just on coffee's image through the media. And so his paper covers, I can't remember the name of the paper, something like Bottom of the Cup or something like that. John Sherry, and the paper is all about how coffee is being conveyed through TV shows. And, you know, there you go. So here we are in Taiwan. That's the only way a lot of people would have seen it.
Yes.
Yeah, particularly in the time scale we're talking about, like 5-8 years ago, even less people were traveling. So the image must have been really, really exotic, really, really exotic, since it's learning from the movies and media and so on. And that clearly creates a very artificial image of what that idea means.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting, yeah.
Stephen, what else? Anything else you want to mention about that? Those are really good points. Energy, relaxing, exotic, kind of imported foreign culture, and modernity.
No, because from these different perspectives, people will use coffee or drink coffee in different ways.
Good point. And let me ask you then, these different perspectives, did they line up very well with different lifestyles groups?
Yes. Yes. And align with the different usage of coffee and different kind of coffees.
Which, of course, then would have implications for how you sell the coffee, because you want to sell it with the image that matches the way that they're going to consume it, right?
Right, right. So it's very obviously that there are different market segment of the coffee or coffee stuff.
Interesting. Can you give us an example of maybe like the energy must be people who are working all the time? That's a lifestyle. People are devoted to their work, achievers, overachievers. Do you have any examples for how these other attitudes?
As you said, when people want to work all the time or work very late, they will drink coffee, and especially if they are in office, maybe they will drink the canned coffee or the coffee mix, just like coffee means
like the three in one coffee and
three in one. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's I see it everywhere, and you can get it in 7-Eleven. We have it in the office at work. when I go and teach in another university, it's there on the shelf. It's just it's everywhere. It's everywhere. The 3-in-1. Sorry, yeah. Stephen, do carry on.
Yeah, but they are given different process of these two kind of coffee. The canned coffee is ready to drink, but 3-in-1. Sometimes you have to prepare it, right?
Yeah, well, you have to get some boiled water. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but for Taiwanese coffee, maybe the ice stuff. I mean the cold coffee.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. They, so if they want to drink the cold coffee, they drink the canned coffee.
And I have to say, when you go to places like 7-Eleven or Family Mart,
yeah, everywhere,
you know, cold right. coffee and way outnumbers hot coffee.
So in this kind of situation, the consumer consume coffee for the convenience.
Mm-hmm.
Convenience.
Yeah.
Very convenient. So they drink it quickly and go back to their work.
So you can down a cup of cold coffee, a can of cold coffee, get some energy and go back to your work.
Yes. But in a different segment, like people view coffee as modernity of exotic stuff. They want consume coffee in a elegant way.
They want to have that kind of environment of that kind of modernity or a foreign kind of exotic feeling.
Yeah, yeah. And in this time, the brew coffee of the coffee shop would be the appropriate choice.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can actually have different, you know, when we go shopping, we can see the result of all this now that we have very clearly segmented different packaging for the different types of coffee.
Yeah, but if they want, if people don't have too much time, but they want to show their modernity of the metropolitan style, lifestyle,
yeah.
They will go to Starbucks.
Yeah, I think that I was just going to say that. Yeah, I think that.
Yeah, to take out a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a symbol people carry with them because I've seen it in so many places, in office locations and at university, EMBA classes. You know, somebody walks in and they're carrying that cup, and it's really a badge of modernity, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's really because over the last 5 years or even less, I think it's probably in the last 1-2 years, the number of cold coffee you see racked in 7-Eleven is just shot right up. There's whole shelving set aside for that now, and see a lot of people grabbing a cup and going. And then also more recently still, they've installed hot fresh coffee machines in the university where I teach, which is really, really interesting. It's a vending machine, but with actual coffee beans. So you're getting quite a high quality cup of coffee. And to be honest, that's not something that you'd see in your sort of UK average campus for sure.
Is that over at your Zhonghua gig over there, James?
That's right. Yes, it is. I was really, really impressed.
You guys got money to burn, don't you?
Oh, well, the students pay for it, you know. And before class, I see one or two of them lining up. I have to say, it's. And I'm thinking, well, I'm the poor professor here, and these I want to go back and be a student.
Yeah, right. Do they have to drop money into the machine?
Yeah, they have to drop some coins in, and I'm usually in a hurry or don't have change, so I haven't tried this little machine out now. But the interesting thing is right at the top, they have a cover, and the beans are really visible in there, and you can really see it making the coffee. And it's not a quick process. So people have to put the money in, hold for a little while, and then the coffee comes out. So yeah. Different segment, different kind of expectation. Kind of interesting, though.
Yeah, we've talked about getting that in my department also, and they're just a little bit hesitant about who's going to take care of it and clean it. But it's an interesting idea, and I think your point lines up with Stephen's well. So you have this people stand there and wait, and it's so different than what we're used to in a lot of Taiwan situations where it's rush, rush, rush. And so I think it's really that process of doing it. And it, in a way, it's similar to the tea process, James and Stephen. You both have many experience having tea, right? Of course, the Chinese tea ceremony is not as complex and intricate as the Japanese one, but still there's many steps to it. And you don't get a cup of tea right away. And I remember once I was out somewhere and there was another Westerner with me and we were drinking tea at somebody's house. And, you know, you get the small little Chinese teacups and he would down it. And then, of course, the host would fill it up again and he'd down it. And he turned over to me after about 20 of these cups and said, "I wish they had a bigger cup." So I think that, you know, the socially everyone's so used to that process. And then the coffee, if you actually put it into a long waiting process, people are easy to accept it because it is a modernity imported thing. And they can relate to it because they do it with tea.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that really makes a lot of sense. And yes, because like you're saying with the tea, I sometimes when I go and meet a businessman, it's very nice. We sit down, we have like tea, and as you say, the ceremony is not a Japanese style ceremony of lots of complexity, but the tea's washed, then gradually you get to actually having your first cup and it's a sip rather than a gulp of the typical British tea.
Yeah, right.
Different approach, for sure.
Different approach. So this all leads me into the project I just recently completed. And I think, Stephen, I'd really like to get your feedback as I go through here because I think there's so much similarity. Now, your research was done about how long ago were you working on that stuff, Stephen? 8 years, did you say?
Yes, a year, over 10 years.
About a decade ago. So you guys were really just at the beginning when the market was just starting to grow, right?
Yes.
Now we, as we talked in the show, we have Starbucks all over the place. We have 85C. And so I had a grant from the government, and they were the Ministry of Agriculture specifically. They asked me to look into how to develop a marketing strategy for increasing the sales of domestically grown coffee. As you both probably know, there are places in Taiwan that do grow coffee, and the weather is fairly hospitable to this, and it's just never been done very much in the past. Now it's a growing market, and so we are going to look into how to handle this, and I took an approach that's very different. In a way, it's similar to focus groups, but it's also a little bit dissimilar, and it's called ZMET, or Zaltman Metaphor Elicitation Technique. And in here, we have deep interviews that we go through numerous steps to get at deep psychological constructs of how people relate to the concept you're talking about, the brand or the product or whatever it is you're talking about.
I think that's interesting. And just to cut in, I mean, why did you choose that technique, Clyde, not maybe a quantitative technique?
Yeah, well, we were competing for the grant, and of course, all the people we're competing with were economists and using econometric models and things like this. And we, you know, we thought we didn't have a chance, so we tried something very different. And the committee picked up on it right away. And I think, you know, we're at a point in marketing where a lot of people really do understand you need to get more into the psychology of the consumer and the complexities. And a lot of these surveys, you know, we're just so flooded with surveys these days. It's really questionable how accurate your feedback is.
Yeah, I think that particularly since you're talking of going in at, as you say, you wanted to uncover those deep psychological constructs. I'm not really sure that you can reach that level of depth with a quantitative survey or even regular interviewing. I mean, having done a reasonable amount of interviewing, I know it's that essentially that conversation with a purpose takes you to talk about behaviors, visible rationalizations of why people have decided to do particular things. But usually it stops just before you get into uncovering some of the psychological or very deep cultural explanation, since they're so deep, essentially, people can't easily talk about their cultural rationalizations for why they behave, and they're only suggested through a regular deep interview. Clearly, here you were trying to go a bit deeper, and I guess ZMAT must have been had some strengths that took you beyond the regular interview.
Yes, that's exactly right. the whole point was to get those deeper psychological metaphors of how people interpret reality, and in this case, reality related to coffee consumption, and specifically if we could, Taiwan-produced coffee. And you can't get that with even focus groups, which tend to be, you know, focus groups have their advantage, but they tend to get off track sometimes in a kind of herd mentality. You know, people are following one person in the group, or they just yeah each other. And so here we're one-on-one, going as deep as we can. And in the slides, you can see the process for ZMAT is a 10-step interview process. And the key to it is before we even interview anyone, we send them a camera with a very short little scenario or story. And I mean really short. In this case, it's like half a sentence. It just says, a friend of yours went out to have some fun. He came back and gave you a gift of Taiwan coffee, which actually is a pretty common behavior in Taiwan. People go to a place called Kending and get some coffee locally grown and give it as a gift. And then we give them a camera, and that camera is a disposable camera. They take it with them, and they take photos for a week or 2 weeks, and then they mail it back in a self-addressed envelope to us. And we get it developed, line up an interview, and then we go through a process where we fool around with the pictures, we ask them to explain the photos, and we go deeper and deeper, taking more and more time. Now, I know Stephen's familiar with this because he's actually done some ZMAT interviews with me. We've done them together before. Remember we did that one interview down at Chenda, Stephen? Do you remember that?
Yes. Yes, we do the study of Mormon and Shiji.
Yeah, we were looking at some religious stuff, specifically the imported Mormon compared to the more local Shiji religion. And sometimes it doesn't work, I have to say that. I think that there's a fairly high failure rate. Some people get the camera and they lose it. Some people just take a couple pictures and that's not enough. And then some people, you get them into the interview and they're just not able to move forward. So you'll have the pictures there and you'll say, tell me about this picture. And they'll say something like, well, I took this picture because that person looks interesting. And you say, well, what do you mean interesting? And I say, well, because when I was walking down the street, I saw them, they look interesting. And you say, well, can you explain that a little bit? And you get stuck in a very small loop very quickly and just very linear, and you can't move forward. But for most people, they're very open, and you begin the laddering process step by step. And the Zaltman process is really great because it's structured while it's unstructured. And I think this says a lot about a lot of qualitative research, actually. James, maybe you have some input. You know, a lot of people just say, well, I'm doing this qualitatively. I can just, you know, do whatever I want. But I think the best qualitative methods are actually highly structured, but they still have a lot of room for those changes and individuality to come out. What's your experience with that kind of approach?
Yeah, from my point of view, I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head that there's the risk of saying I'm going to do a qualitative approach and, you know, I can just go with anything. Whereas I wouldn't say they're very structured, but I think there's we could perhaps use the word systematic, and that there's a whole set of rules and procedure that one can learn or understand and then adopt as the situation dictates. And as you say, I think one of the real exciting things from my limited exposure to ZMAT is the fact that it adopts many of the systematic approaches that have been well used in qualitative methods, like laddering, and like some of the underlying principles of repertory grid as well. But where you have the limitations, for example, of repertory grid, that it becomes very, it demands lots of repetition that can quickly become boring and uninteresting for the interviewee. They take the best part of that and just limit it to a few comparisons that force people to explore interesting constructs, helps you to extract relevant ideas, but without becoming so repetitive that it turns off both the interviewee and interviewer. So I think, as you say, it's great because it's systematic, but it draws in many of the well-tested techniques that we've seen people apply in the past in qualitative research. So really the key, I think, is that idea that it can be very systematic, that there are certain procedures you can apply to get good quality data. And ZMAT seems to combine many of these to achieve real rich data very, very quickly. I remember, Clyde, you've talked about how quickly some of the patterns seem to emerge when you're doing this type of research. Have you got some sort of views on that?
Yeah, well, this really speaks to, I think, the two key points, which are the first questions when you present this kind of research, which is validity and reliability. And, validity and reliability in our normal statistical research is mainly dependent on random sample and sample size, and, of course, how you structure your survey and then you do your validity testing early on. Here, we don't really have that option because we're interviewing individuals and we're going very deep and we're talking about, somebody has a camera for a week, they bring that back, they have pictures and photos, which could be 20 to 30, and then your interview could last 2-3 hours easily. So how do you obtain that validity and reliability? And the surprising part is, before I did it, I didn't think it was possible, that after even just 3 or 4 interviews, you begin to very quickly see these are some common threads that run between these respondents, and it sometimes jumps right out at you. So in this case, it could be words they're saying, concepts they're talking about. And if we look in the PowerPoint presentation, we have on slide 18 a fishbone chart which shows the 6 main concepts that came out in the interviews, and they came out fairly quickly, and as an interviewer you feel it right away. Me, I had a group of people we were working with, so we were interviewing through different interviewers, and they bring the data back to me, we put it together, and surprise, after just a few, we see there are these commonalities. And it lines up really well with what Stephen was talking about, because we have, for example, of course, flavor and aroma is a big one. Culture, and specifically that exotic imported culture, is a big one. We also have a nature emphasis, where people feel that there's something about trees and flowers and nature. And then, of course, we have different types of coffee, and Stephen's mentioned that too, because I think some people just want it to be strong and you get right to the energy. Other people want it to have different flavors and aromas. And a big one was feelings that people have from it. And I think Stephen's focus group also shows us, even across different segments, everybody has a different kind of feeling about it. So these were big topics we got almost right away. James, it came out so fast, it's surprising. And if I hadn't done it, I don't believe it. And I've done ZMAT methodology a few times now, and it's amazing how fast this comes out. And I think this speaks a whole lot to that kind of reliability, when after a few people, you get the same core concepts coming out. Stephen, you were involved in some of the Mormon and Tzu-Chi stuff. Do you remember that? And we were getting, it was not hard to see some key concepts come out fairly quickly.
Yep. I think the concept from the informants converge very fast.
Yeah, exactly. They converge very quickly. So, I'm always asked at the beginning of presentations, well, how do you do your sample size and how do you have your validity testing and how do you check your reliability? And I think these are general questions that qualitative research always runs into, but ZMAT handles them very elegantly. And I think another one is, for example, when we're talking about validity, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, Stephen, but validity is handled really well in ZMAT, because one stage in ZMAT is you actually ask, can you pick the most representative picture? Now, this whole process is called photo elicitation, where you're pushing people to talk about the photos they took. So they have a kind of personal involvement, which keeps them interested, as James was mentioning. That's kind of the kind of device to keep them going. And in there, we say, what's the most representative? And they pull it out. And in our research, for example, the most representative pictures across all the respondents had to do with giving a gift or giving something to someone or feeling good to be with somebody. And the reason this is a good validity check is because our original story or scenario we gave them was you go and give a gift to someone. So this lets us know that the respondents really understood what the scenario was. So it's kind of a check on, are we asking the right question? Are they answering the right question? Are we in alignment? And I think that's something that a lot of people who are not familiar with qualitative research miss. There is a way to check validity. James, what's your take on that?
Well, I think that from the validity point of view, that and the reliability point of view, that it's easy to get stuck into the mode of a quantitative perspective on both of these, and that you have to move away from that and say, well, actually, the core concept of validity takes us back to, are we really getting answers on the topic that we want to look at? And as you say, one of those constantly involves checking back with both the data that's emerging in that theoretical sampling that Strauss and Gorbin have talked about, as well as in that practical sense, checking back during the interviewee with the interviewee, are the concepts really valid to them as meaningful representations of what they're talking about? So I think that's important. I think from the reliability point of view too, that what you're showing here, and I believe it used the program Excite like I do, which really, really helps on the reliability front to demonstrate exactly the steps that you've gone through as a researcher and how you've arrived at those conclusions. So as soon as someone points at one of your constructs that we're looking at this, I've got the consensus map just up on the screen in front of me. I think that's your slide 33.
Yeah.
I'm quite sure as soon as someone pointed and said, look, there's a construct here, work, there's another one, relax, how does that then link straight back to your data? And I'm sure since you've used Excite and you have the images in a really structured, I see the labels on some of those photographs in your PowerPoint, so it would be really easy then to link that right back to the data. So that makes a really powerful statement, I think, about the reliability and the ability to replicate what you've done here.
Yeah, well, that's the great time saver. I mean, we could do this kind of work 20, 30 years ago, but today we have this software like Excite, which means that if this question comes up, well, how, you know, does this work concept here in your consensus map really have reliability? And we can just click right into it, go right to find out how many people did talk about it. And we can click right down to finding out what were their exact words about it. And then you find out, yeah, there's across 10 people, they had these words, and look how similar those words are. That speaks directly to that reliability issue.
And that's often the way that people feel uncomfortable with qualitative data. But once you actually show that and really put the rationalization for linking up the ideas that underlie the construct of work, then people immediately, it makes sense that reliability is interpreted in that way, in a qualitative sense. And I mean, some people have commented that validity is slightly more important than reliability in from a qualitative point of view. I'm not quite sure that's entirely true, but I think probably the focus is a little bit more on validity than reliability.
Well, this up to this point, you know, this is all pretty lines up with Stephen's stuff pretty well. But then there's one step further in ZMAT, and that's what I want to cover, and that's all the photos we have on the webpage. I put them up here special so you can just scan right through them. And this is kind of at the end of the interview, the respondent and the interviewer are getting a little bit tired out. Hopefully defenses are lowered way down. We've also kind of moved away from personalizing the photographs, although the person still has a feeling that these photographs were photographs they took. We've disconnected the photos from their context of taking them, and they've just become images that somehow link up with deeper images or metaphors to the topic, which in this case is coffee consumption. And what's really amazing, if we scan through these photos, I have like a photo first of the collage or the summary image without any interpretation, and then with interpretation. It's really amazing. Across these 20 respondents we have, we see a lot of roads and cars and motorcycles. And very often those roads, cars, motorcycles, or even feet or trains are in between going somewhere. So for example, going from an office and then going to a park or a tree area. And even just respondent number one, you can see this very clearly. He goes from his home.
That's interesting, Clyde. I'm just going to dive in because I just want to get clear on a few of the things that you've talked about. You've mentioned the photographs, but I've got up slide 19 here, and these are looking like parts of photos. And then respondent number one, is this what we're looking at in slide 19 here?
19 is a big piece of paper. It's two A4 pieces of paper. And then we asked the respondents to take all the photos they were just discussing, which usually maximum is 10 photos, cut them up any way they like, and make a kind of collage, or in Chinese we call it a kind of puzzle. And this is really easy for Chinese consumers because they've grown up from kindergarten. They often make collages. It's something they accept. In the actual ZMAT approach, you're supposed to use a computer, tablet, and do some imaging. And that really makes people feel uncomfortable in Taiwan, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And so this is just, people fall right into it. Steven, you remember we did this. We had the scissors and the glue, and people,
yes,
people have no trouble to do it.
No trouble. Yeah, no trouble with you.
And so what this picture is the complete finished summary image of one respondent. And you can see that in this case, he's just taken maybe four or five little pieces of pictures, cut them out. And you can see they've cut them out to quite a detail, that car there. So he's totally isolated the car from his original photograph. So he's really emphasizing that car. And then he can write on the paper, draw more pictures, even color it if they want to. And in this case, it's quite clear they're going from a morning at home where they're supposedly waking up, driving a car somewhere, going to do some social event or some dinner, and then going back to a rest. So we have a kind of traveling metaphor going on here, going somewhere. And at no time did we ever mention cars, roads, or traveling in the scenario or in the interview, but across almost all the respondents, they have images of going somewhere, which, right away tells us there's something deeper there. They don't talk about it. It's not in the words of the interview, but it's in the pictures.
Yeah. And that I think is really interesting, because you say it's like barely even one sentence scenario. And then this is really emergent data.
Very much. I mean, just jump down two more photos to see the next respondent in the PowerPoints. That would be 21 and 22. On the webpage, that would be 3 and 4. And right there in the middle of this collage is a train track. And I love the 3D effect he's got going there.
Yeah, it really takes you right through his personal journey, actually, yes.
Exactly. So what I've done is I've taken some little color splotches and interpreted the pictures. And this is what we do. We sit down and go through them all and see what images are similar across all the respondents. And we came up with two big topics that did not come up in the regular interview, were never actually mentioned. And one is this travel, road, transportation, going somewhere. And the other one would be work or society, because we get pictures of people's offices. We get pictures of tall buildings and high rises. We get pictures of downtown areas. And there seems to be a trend among all the respondents that it's going from. I'm going from work or society, and I'm going to a natural, relaxed place. And the way to go there, or the goal on that road, is related to coffee and related to friends and being with other people. And all that comes up in the regular interview. But the two points that never come up in words are that work and society, and then that transportation, moving somewhere. And so we find that these two concepts are deep metaphors that people don't even mention or talk about, but everyone seems somehow to have a picture in their mind when they're talking about coffee.
That's so interesting. So basically those are two constructs that you're not reaching through a regular interview. They're something that's emerging as deep psychological, culturally construed kind of constructs.
Exactly. And Stephen, what's your take on that? These two big ones, a lot of the things we found line up exactly with what you were talking about. But then these two ideas, I didn't hear you mention. What's your response when I say that, it seems like across all our respondents, when we're talking about coffee consumption, there's these two deep ideas, getting somewhere, going somewhere, or maybe transporting to somewhere, and this work in society. What's your feeling on that?
About the transportation, I mean the cars.
Yes.
I think maybe because the Taiwanese coffee is up on the mountain, like Guken.
Yes.
Yeah. So the people in the city have to travel to there.
Yeah.
So they In their procession, if they want to drink Taiwan's coffee, they have to go there.
Have to get
to the mountain
somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even in the pictures, when they're clearly not going to Kending or any of these places where there is Taiwan coffee, there's still that feeling, that going, you know, that traveling, getting there. So I think that's very interesting.
Maybe it's a metaphor of the escaping.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is.
Escape from the normal daily life or the city life.
Getting away from the city life. And even though you don't have to literally travel somewhere, it seems like everyone is having that transition. I guess that'd be a better word, a transition to that kind of peaceful thing.
Okay. And they want to change the mood from the transition, maybe.
Well, exactly. One of the big categories from the actual interview were feelings and mood. That was the biggest one. Everyone talking a lot about it, that coffee gives you some kind of feelings or mood. And then, of course, you know, some of the really culturally specific ideas that we found were in Taiwan, coffee consumption is a highly social event. Now, that doesn't mean everyone does it socially, but they perceive it as being social. So when we talk to them, they're always saying with friends, with other people. I don't know if they actually do it that way. This is one of the questions I got when I presented the results to the government officials. They say, well, you know, everybody I know, somebody told me, is they drink it alone at home. It's not a big deal. And I said, yeah, that may be true. But if you're going to market it, you need to market it to that concept of that social idea.
The related image needs to fit with people's perception.
Exactly. You may drink your whiskey at home by yourself, but you would like to believe you drink with other people. And so I think that was a big difference that we found. And so we have some recommendations and some interesting results, and we got approval from the government. They're very satisfied with that, and hopefully they can implement some of these ideas. Of course, one of the biggest concepts that was difficult to convey, and Stephen, maybe you can give me some feedback, was that I was trying to convince the committee that you need to think about how you're going to build your brand. What's the concept of the brand? But the committee was very stuck on the market. And the committee was very stuck on the coffee. So they would say things like, well, the Taiwan coffee's flavor is more bitter this way, and we need to change it that way. And it was really classic, because I think it shows how a lot of Taiwanese companies get stuck in the production mode rather than going for the brand concept and then having the product fit in with that.
I
think, yes, that's really interesting, yes, because it's, for my eyes, when I go and drink, say, Starbucks, then it's a bitter, really bitter, acrid kind of coffee. So if you've got a product, then you have to go with the image that's associated with that product and try and push on the key messages that people can relate to that mean something about that product. Yeah, I'm completely with you on that, Clive.
Got to have that meaning, you see. And a lot of these guys who were on the committee were really stuck in the production mode rather than that kind of brand meaning. Stephen, what's your feeling about that? Because I get a feeling it's really common in Taiwan to get stuck on the production mode.
Yeah, right. I think there would be two reasons for that. Members of the committee come from the economic of agricultural economic department, right?
Yes, that's right.
So they are used to seeing things from the market data.
Yeah, econometrics, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So, from the marketing perspective, we would like to struggle on the consumer's perception and psychological needs. So I think your brand concept or brand idea is very useful for them in practice. But you have to persuade them to do in your way.
Yeah, I remember when I had we had to do a quarterly report and a midterm report, and I was in there one day. I had to go down to the government center and present my midterm, and I talked about it. I showed some of the preliminary photographs and the collages, and I interpreted a little bit. And one of them looked at me and just said, "Well, 完全听不懂你在讲什么. I totally don't understand what you're saying."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you are in a different you use the totally different approach from theirs.
Yeah, this is true. And so I think this could be a challenge a lot of marketers face. I mean, probably inside a company also, because if you're trying to find this kind of deeper psychological meaning, and then you've got to turn this data over to a manager, and those managers may be more engineering oriented, they're going to really say, well, how is this actionable? What am I going to do with this? And so I think that's a big issue. And this kind of wraps it up here. I want to wrap it up, but any reactions or last thoughts about that and how we use this kind of data, qualitative research data? James, you have any last thoughts?
I mean, my last thought on it is that you've looked into an area where perhaps there wasn't a huge amount of clear perspective, and that's where qualitative insights offer such really, really useful bedrock to do lots of other analysis, maybe some quantitative work, and by doing it systematically and in a procedure-based way like we've been talking about here, I think you can develop some really clear constructs that people can really relate to and have meaning all on their own, essentially, and that, as you're showing here, can really inform management decisions and offer really useful, deep, clear research insights. So I think this kind of work really shows the strength and the benefit of a qualitative approach in uncovering what's impossible essentially to get at through quantitative study, and when done in a systematic way arrives at high quality results that then provide real good opportunity for the next phase of analysis. So I think it shows all the strengths of good quality qualitative work.
Yeah, I mean, we could easily go from here and move into some conjoint analysis where we can create some different packaging and marketing efforts and then measure it quantitatively. And we have that basis to work from. And we didn't have that basis before. Mm-hmm. Stephen, any last thoughts?
Yeah, okay, back to the reliability and validity you just discussed. I think in qualitative theory, they use trustworthiness instead of reliability. I mean, they have a different kind of the criteria to evaluate the quality of the research.
Yeah, right.
We can get the criteria from the Lincoln and Cuba of the Corbin and Strauss in their book, like grounded theory.
Yeah, the basics of grounded, the basics of qualitative research, I think it's called.
Right? Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So I think GMAT is very systematic and very logical. So I think the managers in Taiwan will upset graduate.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. That systematic approach, and we need to change the way we judge, you know, the results of a study and test its validity and reliability.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as you say, if we use the GMAT first, and then align with the conjoint analysis later, I think this kind of the mixed methodology will be very welcome by the managers.
Yeah, because you end up with some solid results that have numbers they might relate to better.
Yes.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Everyone's looking for the numbers. So
yeah, right.
Great.
Well, the beauty of conjoined is you can actually do what Stephen's talking about, do market segmentation and potential market sizes and preferences. But if you don't know how to begin, like you were saying, James, and you don't know where to begin, so there we go.
Yep, sure.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there. Good show, guys, and I look forward to the next research show, and thanks a lot.
Okay.
This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Meow, 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 meow.